Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. You can hold your applause. It's Wednesday, July 30th, 2014. Impeachment.
Let's impeach the president for lying.
A very strange conversation about impeachment. Is underway in Washington, D.C.
Abusing all the power that we gave him. Shipping all our money out the door.
That's Neil Young's song that was written for George W. Bush's impeachment, the one that Nancy Pelosi took off the table. And by the way, that's a live version that features Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Neil Young. You can find it maybe on your favorite online audio service. That's where I did. And as I have referenced in recent days, I find this whole discussion of impeachment of Barack Obama at the current moment quite amusing and at the same time rather bizarre. Because I have been getting 4 emails a day from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, and some that are attributed to Nancy Pelosi herself. And they're talking about this impeachment stoking a huge fundraising effort that has produced big cash for the Democrats, some $7 million in the last few weeks. Now, as you may know, Sarah Palin, in her own rambling style, and I guess recently she gave a speech where she was slurring her words and appeared to be a little bit loaded. And unfortunately, she was no more lucid loaded than she is when she doesn't appear to be loaded. But she now has some online subscription channel that she has started. And it's very interesting to see the problems that creates for John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, and the Republican team in Washington. Everything's focused on this November's election. And so John Boehner told the press yesterday, hold on, we're not planning to impeach the president. We just want to sue him for overreach on presidential authority. And you may have heard me say that on certain issues, like, for example, the Obamacare Affordable Care Act, where the White House unilaterally made changes to an act of Congress, there is the threat of a legitimate issue there. You may also know that I believe that Barack Obama is vulnerable or liable to impeachment, which is an indictment by the House of Representatives, not removal from office. Only the Senate can do that following the indictment stage. That Barack Obama has violated his oath of office in many ways. Obstruction of justice, failing to bring George W. Bush and his colleagues to trial for war crimes. Failure to end the illegal, unconstitutional surveillance programs that have actually been expanded and cemented into place by Barack Obama. The phony use of the state secrets privilege to prevent prosecution of lawsuits by victims of the Bush administration's torture and rendition programs. The failure of Obama and the Holder Justice Department to prosecute a single bank official for criminal behavior in the mortgage scams that nearly bankrupted our country and almost derailed the world economy. Those are the substantial issues that could be brought against Barack Obama if Republicans and or Democrats wanted to really uphold the Constitution. But the flourish of political drama of the Republicans using their majority power in the House to spend money to hire lawyers to sue Obama, that's bullshit. Because the Constitution is clear. If Congress wants to call the president to account, the impeachment process is the way to do it. But then we have to get practical. It's possible that the Republican-controlled House could vote out charges against Barack Obama, but the current composition of the United States Senate would shut them down in pretty short order. Kind of what happened with Clinton, where two actual indictments, two charges came from the House. It was a total of four, I think, ultimately, and none of them was sustained by the Senate. And, of course, Clinton continued to serve. He dodged the impeachment. But zoom out for a moment here. Nancy Pelosi, the one who blocked impeachment of Bush, is now capitalizing on the perception that some people have that Republicans want to impeach Obama, capitalizing it to the tune of $7 million, $7.6 million, more than 400,000 donations. Now, I believe this is a false alarm, and that while Democrats think the money will help them hold on to or win more seats in the House or Senate this fall, and that it might activate voters who appear to be slumbering through the current political fights, it doesn't look like, even with that money and a little extra activism from party regulars, that the Democrats can win back control of the House or hold on to control of the Senate. Let me pause for a moment to make a reference to a card game that many of you may have played. It's called Hearts. In the game of Hearts, the object is to avoid picking up Hearts and the Queen of Spades. Hearts count 1 point off, the Queen 13 negative points. But if you have the right cards, you can do what's called shooting the moon. That's where you have to collect all 13 hearts and the Queen of Spades, and when you do, you set back each of your opponents by 26 points. Now, I think the Democrats are trying to shoot the moon here. My fear is that they're going to end up with the Queen of Spades and 10 or 11 hearts, 24 or 25 points off at the end of this process. Because unless the gamble works, and the Democrats at least control the Senate after the November elections, which appears unlikely at this point, then it's possible that the new, more Republican Congress could actually impeach Barack Obama. And while it takes a two-thirds vote of the Senate to remove, and that's hard to achieve, impeachment can gain momentum on its own. And as I've pointed out, there are some legitimate issues, and if the Republicans mixed in obstruction of justice, as I've described it, with some of their pet peeves about immigration, about the IRS, blah, 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 who knows what the outcome might be. I think the Democrats are playing with fire here. Or maybe with a hand grenade, and they're hoping the pin will stay in. And for the record, I do not, on balance, support efforts to impeach Barack Obama at this time. But there are significant long-term issues about the power that he has arrogated to the presidency during this term. And I didn't even mention the paperless, process-free assassination of an American citizen named Anwar al-Awlaki by a drone strike ordered by Barack Obama. Of course, the Republicans don't bring that up. So this will be an interesting ride as we head into the annual silly season for Republicans, also known as the August recess. It's going to get crazy, friends. Sadly, the tragic conflict in Gaza continues as Israel continues to pound the Gaza Strip. They say Hamas is their target, but they just took out another UN facility that was designated as a refuge for innocent Palestinians. This was a school at the Jabalia refugee camp. At least 20 people were killed in an overnight airstrike. And let me correct that. It was a series of strikes. The details appear to link it to artillery and not to an aerial assault. And once again, the Israeli military, through Colonel Peter Lerner, said no United Nations facility had been targeted. And once again, they try to create this doubt that, oh, it was an errant mortar shot from Hamas that did this. And I'm sorry, That was unbelievable. Well, it is unbelievable just about every time they utter it. The death toll now tops 1,250 Palestinians, 53 Israeli soldiers, 3 civilians. The Israeli military announced a 4-hour humanitarian window of limited attacks. They didn't promise a ceasefire, but they said, we'll scale it back. And Hamas said, well, never mind. And it added to confusion on the ground so that people really couldn't tell where they could go to avoid being the next victim. Listen to these numbers. Israel has hit already 4,100 sites in Gaza. It's a pretty small place. It's loaded with 1.5 million people. So it's a bloodletting that continues. And the domestic politics are getting interesting because since John Kerry, in a kind of watered-down way, tried to get the Israelis to agree to a ceasefire, and Obama has backed Kerry and has pleaded with Netanyahu to do so, the Zionists are calling on their friends in the United States to attack the President of the United States. And you can tell I'm not Obama's biggest booster. But he has read the script every time. Israel has the right to defend itself. He reads the AIPAC script every damn time. And then he says, but can you please stop killing women and children? And for that, the bloodthirsty pro-Israel extremists in the United States are attacking Obama. It's a bizarre, bizarre time in this world. Back here in the United States, a federal appeals court panel on Tuesday blocked a Mississippi law that doesn't explicitly try to shut down abortion clinics. It just makes it impossible to keep them open. By a 2-to-1 vote, a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit ruled that by imposing a law that would effectively end abortion in the state, Mississippi would illegally shift its constitutional obligations to other states. One of the judges on the panel wrote, quote, a state cannot lean on its sovereign neighbors to provide protection of its citizens' federal constitutional rights. Pre-viability, a woman has the constitutional right to end her pregnancy by abortion, he continued. This law effectively extinguishes that right within Mississippi's borders. Now, it's reassuring to see that these federal judges can see through the smokescreen that anti-abortionists have managed to install in now almost a dozen states. And they're honest about their strategy. The governor of Mississippi has bragged about how he is doing everything he can to close down the last abortion clinic in his state. And unfortunately, the decision didn't overturn the Mississippi law or explore whether the requirement that a clinic have admitting privileges for its doctor at a nearby hospital is justified on safety grounds. Rather, the panel said the law could not be used to close the sole clinic in the state. In Texas, for example, the same issues are in play, but because there's more than one clinic still open, it hasn't reached this crisis point. And so I'm pleased to see some rational thinking displayed by courts in this country when the irrational acts of the anti-abortionists seem to be gaining ground with very little opposition from the Democrats. The Democratic Party was the pro-choice party. Now they've dialed back their terminology to talk about women's health issues and the war on women. But they don't have the cojones to explicitly advocate for abortion rights anymore. And I think that's really sad. The other front in the war on women is sexual assault. And Claire McCaskill, the senator from Missouri, who rammed through weaker legislation to protect the rights of women and men from sexual crimes in the military earlier this year. Well, she is sponsoring a bill that her foe on the military issue, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York, is co-sponsoring. And they have Republican co-sponsors as well. And it is designed to curb the number of sexual assaults on college campuses by requiring schools to make public the result of anonymous surveys concerning assault on campuses and imposing significant financial burdens on universities that fail to comply with some of the law's requirements. And I'm glad to see it. This is important. This is the kind of thing that Congress should be doing. And that, you know, very little production is occurring in this gridlocked election year. So that's a little bit of brightness, but of course it's just a proposed bill. And given the light schedule that the House and Senate have for the balance of this year, it's very unlikely that it will be passed. So it's more election year theatrical PR, I'm sorry to say. Well, every day I pause and thank the people who support this program. And today I want to single out one individual who happens to live in Switzerland, Olivier de Merlot. No, it's not spelled like Merlot, the wine that John Boehner drinks too much of. And he surprised me yesterday by sending some money through PayPal to help me cover the bills coming up here at the 1st of August. And Olivier, I thank you very much. He signed up for a subscription a few months ago. We trade emails occasionally. He's a very bright, thoughtful guy, and I can tell he enjoys these podcasts. So, Olivier, thank you for voluntarily stepping up, and it's very much appreciated. And after I received that, I had a little time yesterday, and I looked at the analytics for the PBC podcast, and I was floored. Do you know that in the month of July, people in 71 countries downloaded a podcast from peterbcollins.com? I'm really, really floored by that. And humbled, as they say, when people aren't really humbled. I'm gratified by it. And, of course, I think 73% of my listeners are in the United States. The country that downloaded only one podcast this month is Yemen. And I'm shocked. I didn't know anybody in Yemen had ever heard of Peter B. Collins. So to those of you scattered around the world, can I ask you to check in by email? You don't have to take out a subscription if you don't want to or you're not able to. I'm not going to harangue you on that. But I would love to hear from those in countries that I didn't know I have listeners in. My email is peter@peterbcollins.com. Just send me a quick note. First name is okay. Tell me what country you're in, how you found the podcast, and what it is that we present here that causes you to listen. That's feedback I would love to hear. And by the way, if you want to subscribe, you know the drill. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. Jason Leopold had a couple of stories published today, one at Vice News. And after I waded through all the soft porn stories that Vice puts on its homepage, I found his lengthy story about the newest whistleblower coming out of the State Department, a guy named John Napier Tye, T-Y-E. And John Tye is determined to blow the whistle without ending up in Russia like Ed Snowden or in a federal military prison like Chelsea Manning. And what he wants to tell us without disclosing any classified information is that he thinks that intelligence collection and storage under the Ronald Reagan-era executive order called 12333, he said that should be of greater concern to Americans than the bulk metadata collection program that was revealed by Ed Snowden and that is mostly operating under the alleged authority of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. Now, like Senator Ron Wyden, who was running around for several years saying, "I wish I could tell you, but they might kill me," this man, Tye, is trying to sound the alarm without providing any real evidence or proof. And I understand his predicament. I understand that he's an intelligent human being who can see what happened to the whistleblowers who preceded him. And I invite you to read this article at vice.com. I'll put up a link to it in the show file for this podcast. and urge President Obama to acknowledge that here is a whistleblower who went by the rules, who went to the internal authorities. And this is a whistleblower the president should be listening to. I hope he will. David Sirota, who we've talked about recently, he was publishing at Pando and got fired. We don't know why. Nobody's willing to tell us the truth about that. But he has a weekly newspaper column that shows up in my San Francisco Chronicle. And he hit one of my pet peeves in his recent column, which is about the subsidies of professional sports teams by providing taxpayer support for their stadia. And Sirota has a list here. Detroit last week became the most prominent example of the trend he's talking about. Officials announced their plan to slash public workers' pension benefits. And on the same day, the billionaire owners of the Detroit Red Wings, the Ilitch family, unveiled details of an already approved taxpayer-financed stadium for the professional hockey team. Now, I saw this play out across the bay from me. Oakland is not officially bankrupt, but it's been in poverty for a long time. And Al Davis, the late owner of the Raiders, extorted money from Oakland not once but twice. Sirota's list continues. In Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel recently passed a $55 million cut to the pensions of municipal workers, and at the same time, he's promoting a plan to spend, guess what, $55 million of taxpayer money on a hotel project that's part of a stadium development. In Miami, the report is that the city approved a $19 million subsidy for a professional basketball arena and 6 weeks later began considering a plan to cut as 700 librarian positions and maybe some cops. In New Jersey, Big Fat Chris Christie is blocking a planned $2.4 billion payment to the pension system. At the same time, his administration has spent a record $4 billion on subsidies and tax breaks to corporations. And when you couple this with these really insidious tax inversions that we've been talking about, where a corporation reflags from Switzerland or Ireland to avoid paying taxes here, this is a stunning shift. Corporations used to pay about a third of the total revenue collected by the IRS. That number is down below 10% today, and they're working to drive it to zero. And speaking of Detroit, I want to commend the New York Times for publishing a think piece by Jason Stanley in today's edition, because he recaps the origins of the bankruptcy in Detroit. And there are a number of truths here that unfortunately have not really been laid out for most Americans. He recounts how back in 2011, the Republican legislature passed Public Act 4, which provides for emergency managers appointed by the governor. In November of 2012, the citizens of the state of Michigan voted to repeal Public Act 4. The Michigan legislature responded to this Democratic expression by passing Public Act 436, essentially reinstating it, and the governor signed it into law the following month. Isn't that democracy in action? This article also points out that the $18 billion figure that's always tossed around about the aggregate of Detroit's debt is bullshit. It's highly inflated, in large part simply inaccurate. Detroit actually has a cash flow problem that is currently pegged at a couple of bills under $200 million, not $18 billion. And, of course, the cutoff of water supplies that has drawn a lot of attention to the plight of impoverished residents of Detroit is just one aspect of this undemocratic power grab in Motown. The New York Times is continuing a series of great editorials about legalization, federal legalization of marijuana in this country. And in today's installment, they talk about the history, the reefer madness, origins of the war on drugs and the prohibition of marijuana. And it started out because blacks and Hispanics were smoking weed in Texas. And if you know the Reefer Madness era in the 1930s, they connected hemp, which has no THC, no psychoactive ingredient. They decided that hemp was like weed, and therefore they would outlaw all of it. And I think this editorial does a great job of explaining how hysteria has driven the regulation of cannabis. Back in 1937, they held hearings, and they trotted out witnesses, not a single person who had done significant research into the effects of cannabis. One of those who testified said that a single marijuana cigarette could induce a homicidal mania. And Franklin Roosevelt signed the ban into law following that. So it's important history. I'm glad the Times is doing that. A few weeks ago, I noted that I was stunned by comments from conservative Latino newspaper commentator Ruben Navarrete from San Diego. And today, he published another column that hits home with me. He is striking back on Ted Cruz. He opens by saying the senator doesn't get immigration, nor does he understand the need to give due process to refugees. And he recaps how Ted Cruz is artfully conflating. That's when you intentionally lie, by mixing irrelevant things together. He says, in trying to solve the border crisis, the senator mixes together three unrelated things. The DREAM Act, which offered undocumented youth legal status if they went to college or joined the military. That was defeated in December 2010. A 2008 anti-human trafficking law signed by Bush. And deferred action for childhood arrivals, which was the policy change that Obama initiated in 2012. He writes, it's apples, oranges, and bananas, yet for conservatives, it's all one anarchic fruit salad. And finally today, occasionally I update you on the rogue utility that provides the power that has the lights on here right now. They're called Pacific Gas and Electric. And going back a couple of years, in September of 2010, PG&E's gas pipelines blew up in the community of San Bruno, which is near the San Francisco International Airport. 8 or 9 people died, 8 people, 38 homes were destroyed. And today, it was announced that the federal government has expanded to 27 counts in a voluminous indictment against PG&E. Some of it is for a cover-up following the San Bruno incident. And that cover-up has been aided and abetted by none other than the Regulatory Commission that is supposed to represent my interests, the Public Utilities Commission. Arnold Schwarzenegger, the actor who acted as governor for too long here, appointed a man named Michael Peavy as the chair of the Public Utilities Commission. He's a former CEO of Southern California Edison. He has no business running the agency that regulates utilities. And, as if we needed proof, emails were recently published by the San Francisco Chronicle showing that the chair of the Public Utilities Commission was sending emails to executives at PG&E advising them on how to avoid bigger fines, how to wriggle out of accountability for the death and destruction that their lax standards and their intentional efforts caused. In one email exchange between a chief of staff at the PUC named Carol Brown and a former PUC staffer, Laura Dahl, who now works as a top official at PG&E. Well, Carol Brown suggested to Laura Dahl that the company fight a public information request related to a safety seminar. Brown said PG&E could send a sweet note deflecting the request and then wait for them to throw a fit. Alternately, PG&E could answer any simple question but refuse to answer others. And the aptly named Laura Dahl responded to Carol Brown with two words, love you. In another case, we see an email from Peavy himself to a top PG&E executive criticizing the PR tactics of PG&E and offering ideas on how they could do it better. And correctly, today's lead editorial in the Chronicle, coupled with calls from the mayor of San Bruno and the congresswoman from that area, Democrat Jackie Speier, they're all calling for Michael Peavy to be fired as chair of the PUC. And Governor Jerry Brown has to listen because he has ignored these calls for several years now. And it's way past time that Michael Peavy gets the boot. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. I'm asking you to share this podcast and put it up on Facebook. Share it with your friends there. Thank you very much.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until